Welcome to Juice Podcast. I'm Emily Harmon.
And I'm Jamie Good.
And we're back at Hamyard Hotel, tasting some more wines and talking about another interesting topic that Jamie knows quite a bit about.
We're going to talk about viticulture.
Viticulture.
The interesting stuff, the new stuff. Very interesting area, I think, of wine at the moment. Increasing focus on the way that vines are grown, the ways that vines can be grown that are truly sustainable, and also facing some of the challenges of climate chaos. You know, the vine has been described, I think it was Richard Smart described the grapevine as the canary of the canary in the coal mine of global warming, because vines are exquisitely sensitive to differences in temperature. You know, some varieties ripen well in some areas, and then other areas that have not got drastically different climates simply won't work for those varieties. So vines are very sensitive to their environment. So when the environment is disrupted, then we have to think about, well, how can we minimize that disruption? What do we need to do to future-proof wine production in a changing world?
And recently you wrote a book on this specific topic.
Yes, it's called The New Viticulture.
Which I'm so happy it's come out, because as somebody who sometimes loathes or gets a little bit frustrated, let's say, with formal education around wine, I feel like the viticultural piece is always, there's one way of doing this. Maybe you decide how the vine grows, but it's like, there's this way that you do it, and this is the way that you do it. Like, it's the techno approach to viticulture.
Yes.
That you're often taught. And I feel that there's not enough education around all these different paths and all these different considerations and decisions you can make when you're growing grapevines.
Yeah, and I'm so interested in this subject, because my training as a scientist, well, I did my PhD in plant biology, and I love plants. And, you know, for me to come to wine was very exciting, because there is this emphasis on vineyards and vines, and the way that with other drinks you don't get the same emphasis on the raw ingredients. And the thing with wine is that, you know, when it comes to fine wine, the raw ingredients are absolutely intrinsic to the qualities and characters of what you end up with. So you've got, you know, this saying people come out now, wine is made in the vineyard. Well, it's actually true, because there's, you know, when you've got the grapes in the winery, you've got the potential for a certain level of quality. So winemaking is necessary to realize that potential. But you can't go further past that sort of potential and having super duper winery trickery to make a really great wine out of mediocre grapes doesn't work. If you think about whiskey or beer, the grains that are used to make the whiskey or beer, they have to be of good quality, but beyond that, nobody goes to visit a distillery and then goes to see the wheat fields or the barley fields. Similarly with beer.
Actually, it's interesting, Jamie, because there's an Irish whiskey distillery called Waterford, and they've been working with a guy who's at Portland University called Dustin Herb to prove that terroir can be detected in whiskey.
Well, that's super interesting. And yeah, I know with beer, they talked about terroir in beer, because,
yeah,
but mainly to do with the water. So if you look at the beer styles that have kind of developed in different countries and different regions, often the favoured beer style has been developed because that's what the local water produces best.
Like in sake.
Yeah. So that's super, that's really interesting, but that's not about the raw ingredients. So I'm fascinated that suddenly there's a discussion about the quality of the raw ingredients that's used. And I guess with beer, also you have the hops, where the hop type is very important.
Yeah.
But I think the wine is kind of much more nuanced and more pronounced, this you know, idea that the grape quality gives you.
But I wonder, I feel like I want to challenge that a little bit, because, yeah, again, it's not from any backed up point of view on, yeah, my side, but is that just because there are so many wines being made by single plots and we don't have access to that same material when it comes to whiskey? If you think about most whiskies, yeah, a lot of them are blended, they're not single, like black batch, they're not single vintage. Like, maybe if we actually saw, I mean, again, the ABV and the production method maybe changes that, but there could be an expression that we don't get to see just because of what the product we have access to.
That would make whiskey much more interesting. And I think one of the problems with whiskey is like, is that time is so much of the essence that you've got this very long aging process. But what about if whiskey, people could suddenly start making whiskies that were shorter aged, because obviously that's a big problem in terms of locking up capital and getting things to market, but that gave a sense of place to the whiskey through the raw ingredients. That'd be very interesting. That's
I mean, we're already starting to see it in sherries, right?
Well, this is
overlooked before.
But this is the thing. What we've got is we've got this narrative in champagne and sherry where the big companies have taken it over. And so the narrative in champagne is that base wines are all, you know, so much, but it's that long aging in the cellars on lees that gives the character to fine champagne. So you've got...
And the non-vintage approach. You've got
very famous, you know, icon champagnes made from grapes and must that have come from the cooperative, or base wines that have come from the cooperative and have just been put in the cellar for a very long time. And then sherry, you've got this sort of like, it's, oh, Palomino's just neutral, we just take it. And it's the production process, the factories that give the character to sherry. And there's some great sherries that come from these big factory sherry producers. But now you've got this new narrative, which is going back to the past, where it's about the vineyard, the pago.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting because, you know, we're told one thing in wine education, and then when you go to the region, you see the people who love the stuff and are making... these biologically aged sherries from specific sites that have a lot of character in them. Palomino is not a neutral grape variety when it's farmed well and it's on good sites and it's cropped sensibly.
And it's so, like, and it's a transparent varietal in the way that it really can speak. Like, I feel like it's easy to, not easy to, but it's a bit like Riesling in the way that it can really showcase that soil type as well.
And there's six types of Albarita. Who knew this?
Yeah.
Well, they do. The people in the region go back to the past. And in the past, the sherry would be made in the pago. You know, they had these wineries in the middle of the vineyards that are mostly in disrepair now. But the wines would be made there and then taken in cask back to Jerez or, you know, San Luca or Santa Maria. So it would be like a, you know, but now that we've got this narrative that it's the production process that gives the quality, because that suits big companies, because then they can just ramp up volumes and scale everything. And in Champagne now, you've got a lot of people now who maybe... that to some of the growers, they'll say, well, we're going to put character into our base wines by farming well, and then we'll maybe have just 18 months or 2 years on the lease.
Yeah.
And suddenly you've got these amazing champagnes that haven't needed an extended time on the lease to show their personality, because they've got the personality from the site.
On that note, I'm just going to pour the champagne that we actually have. You can't really hear it. It doesn't have the same...
Maybe you can hear the bubbles. There's some interesting studies on listening to bubbles, and people can recognise the difference between Prosecco, sparkling water and champagne just by listening to the sound of the bubbles.
This one's a little bit like listening to the ocean when it's first poured.
So tell me about this champagne.
Yeah, so we're drinking Champagne de Houx Tradition Extra Brut. It's non-vintage. So this is from the list at Hamyard Hotel. And actually... this has a bit of a story which I didn't tell you before this. We found that it was getting increasingly difficult to source champagne. So during the pandemic, actually the hotel had a group contract before. And as with many customers, the supply that we were contracted to was not delivered upon. So we couldn't actually get the stock of sometimes, like Mulet, for example.
Really?
There were shortages. Can you imagine?
No.
Because they kind of rejigged their distribution route. So they were... aiming for duty free or I don't know, like stores or whatever. And because of that, we started to think a little bit outside of the box. For those of you that are listening, Hamyard Hotels, Ferndale Hotels, and it's a group that I've been consulting for now for 2.5 years. I work very closely with the group F&B manager who you met today, Sarah Williams. Yeah, so we work on the wine list together. And it was clear that it was going to be problematic and we didn't want to compromise by getting a kind of generic industrial cheap champagne, but we knew we wanted to keep something that was still at a democratic price point. Both Sarah and I love to drink grower producers, so Sarah gave me a research topic of trying to find a producer that we could import directly for the hotel group. So I did some work, narrowed it down to about 5 producers. Benoit Dehou was one of them. Actually, he makes the family domain, which is Champagne Dehou, which is this. And then he makes his own label wines called Benoit Dehou, which is like 4,000 bottles. Here we're at like 40,000 bottles total production. Whoa, it was Dehou.
Yeah,
I think he's like 8 hectares in total, only producing from his own grapes in the so Valais de Marne. Predominantly Pinot Meunier, and then with a bit of Pinot Noir and a small amount of Chardonnay, like 6% Chardonnay.
Lovely.
And it's 36 months on the lease.
It's got that lovely Pinot Meunier fruitiness, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Some mandarin and cherry and lemon.
Yeah, and also, really nice. For me, it's also the textural piece, right? The wine, going back to our point, like when we've spoken before, like I find that's natural balance in the wines, because even though they're dry, it's a drier style, that kind of fruity and the kind of texture of the wine and the creaminess of the wine, probably also coming from the lees, but also from the varietal, means that I feel it's quite an accessible style, even if you're not into grower champagnes. If this was Chardonnay, 100%, it'd be maybe a bit more tense, nervous, a little bit more crisp. But yeah, anyway, we visited him. When we visited him, we really fell in love with the wine, and we went with the group purchasing manager Chris, and all three of us like, we want the who, but he didn't have the volume, so we said, look, we'll start with you, we'll just do with Hamyard, and then after a year now he supplies the hotel, so we take a significant amount.
Great.
We exclusively have it in the UK, just here, and he's certified organic I think since 2021.
That's great.
Yeah,
because I was in the Champagne.
We sell that for £80.
And it was so hard to find vineyards that hadn't been herbicided.
Yeah.
So to hear of organic producing champagne, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And someone who wants to certify too. But yeah. Anyway, really cool producer. Like the wines a lot. They're not messed around with. It's all in stainless steel, even the base wine. His own label wines, which are sold through, I think, Rayburn. They have barrel on them. I think pretty yummy. The dosage, I think, is something like 3 on this.
Yeah.
And it's £80.
Very good.
So instead of adding the importer margin, we decided not to. This way, it's like we get an okay margin, but it means that like guests here basically drink a wine that would usually be 110, 120 for £80.
Yeah, fantastic.
But we don't have commercial stuff. We ended our contract and, yeah. I think it's pretty cool. So take that, the rosé and vintage champagne. So that's what that is. But again, it leads into naturally what you said. And anyway, we've kind of digressed a little bit from our topic around viticulture.
Let's get back to viticulture, because I think what's really interesting about viticulture is for a long time in wine circles, we kind of thought about viticulture in 3 different ways. And it's a sort of pyramid. And it's a pyramid, ascending pyramid of virtue as well. So you think of conventional growers.
Yep.
So the people who farm vines, they'll use herbicide for weed control. They'll add fertilizer to make up, you know, chemical fertilizer to make up for the stuff that the vines have used. And they'll use systemic fungicides to deal with disease. And they'll use insecticides to deal with insect problems. So they're using basically a chemical arsenal.
Yeah,
it's effective. It produces grapes, produces a solid crop, and obviously people need to be economically sustainable to be sustainable. But the problem with it is that's not sustainable because the soils get depleted. I was in Champagne looking at these herbicided vineyards, you see the soil is really lifeless. The only things growing are these weird, very resistant weeds that grow. So you can, but there's not many of them. It just looks really lifeless and barren. So basically you're doing all the work with the chemical arsenal.
Yeah.
And your soil quality is depleted, there's erosion happening. It's something that's going to eventually end
up. It's not a long-term plan, is it? It's not sustainable.
And I understand the economics, right? So a lot of people are not being paid enough money for their grapes because we're addicted to cheap wine and we're not prepared to pay for grapes that have been farmed the right way. So then after that, you've got that bottom layer of conventional wine growth.
Yeah.
Then after that, you've got sustainability schemes. You know, you get certified sustainable. And this is admirable in the sense that people are keeping records of what they do. Okay. There's some things they're not allowed to use. But then again, there's things they're allowed to use that I don't think are terribly sustainable, like herbicides and certain chemicals. It's kind of like a...
Well, also sometimes, isn't it, with some of... Even if you're certified organic or certified biodynamic, don't you have to also then sort of ascribe to, like, the certified treatments, which are then shipped to you as well, so that, it, like, it's not always necessarily, like... Example, I import Domaine Ligas into Germany, and Melly said that they never got the biodynamic certification because the preparations that they make are from things that they forage in the local environment, so they wouldn't actually get the certification by using that because they're not purchasing.
That's a very interesting question. And we can come back to that later, but just before I do that, I say about sustainability. You've jumped a little bit too far. But we need to just deal with sustainability because I think it's admirable and people sign up, they get a badge saying it's sustainable, they keep records. That's going to help them to farm better.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of thought goes into these sustainability schemes, but sometimes the problem with them is that they're not really sustainable in the sense of, can you carry on doing this for 500 years? Because if you can't, it's by definition not sustainable. So I don't think that many of these sustainability certifications are doing justice to the term sustainable, because they're not truly sustainable. So that's a little problem, I think.
How and could they be sustainable? How do you think they could be sustainable? What would be the, let's say, I don't know, the top three things that could change for that?
Well, I think to be truly sustainable, you have to be able to carry on doing something for a long time. But I think the true sustainable way of farming is what we're going to come on to a bit later, which is this idea of regenerative viticulture, which is about building up what we call ecosystem services. It's seeing viticulture as part of an agro-ecosystem. So not just the crop plant, you're seeing the stuff under the soil, very important, all the life there. You're seeing the stuff above the soil. You're bringing in biodiversity to get the environment as an ecosystem to do the jobs that previously were being done by chemicals. Inputs. And you're improving the soil life, you're improving the soil organic material. It's a kind of win-win situation. So that's what we're aiming for. That's true sustainability. Then we've got this third, tier of the pyramid right at the top, organics and biodynamics. So put them together. I know they're not exactly the same, but they kind of evolved at the same time in the 1940s. 30s and 40s were when they were being developed. And there was some overlap at the time. It was very interesting. So I wrote about this in my book. The people who were developing the biodynamic practices as a result of the lectures that Rudolf Steiner gave in 1928 took a while to develop what this meant in practice. They were very esoteric lectures. But so Ehrenhard Pfeiffer was the guy who kind of developed all these. And there was some overlap with the development of the organic movement, which happened in the UK in the 30s and early 40s. And basically, that's about soil health. And it was a very welcome correction to the rise of industrial farming.
Yeah.
And suddenly people said, no, we need to look at the soil and the soil health and soil life. And so biodynamics and organics, I think, are very important. But I don't know if they're fully sustainable, because in some climates, you have to use a lot of copper.
Yeah.
To protect against downy mildew. And copper's not something you really want to be spraying with your soils. And also, they love to till the soil, turning the soil over, ploughing it. And when you understand what's going on under the surface, you don't necessarily want to be turning the soil, because that disrupts the microbial life in the soil.
Let's get to tilling a little bit later.
Yeah. But I think what's really interesting now is we're coming to an understanding that really there's, our understanding of what happens in an environment of a vineyard has grown, and the science has got better as well. And we're getting to a more complete understanding that says that what we need to do is create these, as I said before, agro-ecosystems. This is regenerative farming. And increase the biodiversity in the vineyard. It makes the vineyard more resilient for a start once you've got more things growing in it. And you're not resorting to these chemical solutions which degrade the life in the soil and leave the vineyard open to more pests and more, you've got this complete monoculture. It's going to be a bad idea. Because, you've got a monoculture of genetically identical individuals, these clones of vines, and bare soils, it's just not good.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a producer, I don't know if you would know the wines or not, but called Cantina La Baqueta, and I think she's in her third vintage. She's 24 years old. She's farming regeneratively. And she said to me, even in this way, she's like, I understand, by growing vines in this soil, I'm taking from it. So I have to grow regeneratively because I have to put back what I'm taking. And it was like, I hadn't really thought about that in that way. But I think, you know, like, it's that point, right? Like, you can't, like, bare soil, growing those vines, what's going to happen? Like, what's actually going to grow? Like, how is that healthy? Think about, like, that in any other scenario.
So what I'm fascinated by is, because I've traveled a lot, especially, like, there's a period between 2016 and 2020 when the pandemic kicked in, that I was on the road almost the whole year.
Yeah.
And the benefit of that is seeing different wine regions. And what I reckoned is that you can't have a recipe, because there's different climates, there's different soils.
But isn't that the same with winemaking, when we talk about techno winemaking?
Totally, yeah.
It's like we could all be a Michel Roland and just, you know, to say, hey, there's one way of making wine and it's just like this. But, like, what is that even?
Recipes are disastrous when it comes to viticulture. Yeah. So what we saw a lot of was when people who were planting Pinot Noir around the world, that they saw, obviously, Burgundy makes, they said, obviously makes the most famous Pinot Noir in the world. So we'll look and see how they grow their vines. Well, there's lots of reasons they grow the vines the way they do, but what you saw is people in other climates and other countries planting vineyards the same way that they were planted in Burgundy and in other climates and other countries. This can be a disaster.
Mm.
You've got to be much more intelligent, and I think that's why I think organic survivalness is great, but it's almost like it's a checklist approach. This is what you should be doing. And you mentioned about the Ligas in Greece having to import things to do biodynamics.
No, if they wanted to be certified, they said, like, no.
And that's really intelligent. And I think what the problem with biodynamics, I see it, is it's very rigid and it's not evolved. And what you do is you need to say, well, this is the principles of biodynamics. How can we apply it in our local situation? I remember speaking to a Chilean winemaker who was, to be certified biodynamic, he had to have stag's bladders for one of the preparations. And they don't have deer in Chile.
But that's not one of the main...
No, it's not one of the main
either.
Ones.
Like, why would that be...
Because they needed a stag's bladder for one of the preps. It's not one of the main preps. It's one of the supplements.
It's very pagan, isn't it? But you must sacrifice.
So it's like, we don't have them. But why don't you locally adapt your... And I tasted a lovely wine last night, the Cacciabella Grand Selezione.
Oh, Cacciabella, yeah, from Chianti.
And they do vegan biodynamics, so they don't use any of the animal bits in their preparations for biodynamics. It's really intelligent. Adapt it to your own way of doing things. Take it as a guideline. Adapt it to your local situation. So when it comes to regenerative viticulture, I think there should be a recipe. What there should be is this understanding that you've got a toolkit of approaches that can help you to improve your soils, improve biodiversity in the vineyard. Depending on where you are, you might use some, you might use others. And so one of the toolkit items would be, for instance, cover cropping. So you choose your cover crops intelligently depending on where you are. In some places, you know, you might have very different desires and needs. You know, your soil might be deficient in this, so the cover crop provides this resource.
Yes.
So that's a toolkit. That's
well, it's
toolkit.
A bit like diet, right? Like, think about human diet.
Yeah.
You and I might have very different diets because it's what our body needs. We also live in different places. We have different, maybe, athletic, you know, activities that we do, with how much we do it and all of that sort of stuff. It's like, why would you not consider a plant and an environment the same way? Because the context of everything is very different.
So another thing that's interesting as well, this idea of agroforestry, which is growing trees, well, initially hedges, but then trees within the vineyard itself. And that's fascinating. That's been... In France, they're going big on this, a lot of people.
Yeah, I was just recently in Grados, and Danny and Fernando at Commando G have been planting a lot of new trees around their vines. Not that necessarily you need it in Grados, because it's such a wild region anyway, but still, they're mindfully doing that.
Then composting, that can be really interesting.
Yeah.
No-till approaches, I think, is one of the ideas is, if you don't have to, don't disturb the soil. Some places like California, the actual row itself, you have to, because they get these gophers involved. So if you leave cover in the actual vine row itself, then you can lose lots of vines because of these mammals that chew at them, and they're real pain apparently. But
for the non-gopher world, like, because I think the tilling thing's quite interesting, right? Because it comes up, and again, I feel like the tilling topic can get very dogmatic with some people's views. There are some people that are like, I'm no till, that's the way it is. Other people are like, well, I till, and I think again, it's an, I think there's nuance there.
Yes.
But I think for people who are tuning in, they're like, what the hell is tilling? What does that mean? Why would you do it? Why would you not do it? What are the impacts? Is it, there is a CO2 emission that happens. So yeah. Would you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so the whole idea of tilling is what we call floor management in your vineyard. So, and this will really be very, very different. If you're in a humid area where you get growing season rainfall, it'll be very different than if you're in the Mediterranean or California where you get very little rainfall during the summer.
Yeah.
So you take quite different approaches there, but it's if you just let your vineyard grow, the vines will get out-competed by the other stuff growing in the vineyard,
yeah.
they'll die. So you need to do something about what we call weeds, but I think weeds is maybe a harsh term. It's about the other growth in the vineyard. How do you manage it? And the cheapest way to do that is to use herbicide and kill it off. And people then start thinking, well, bare soil is maybe not the best thing, so they'd have maybe grass growing in the actual inter-row between the two.
So if you were out of the EU, this could be an option to be spraying Roundup?
Well, in the EU, still spraying it.
Illegally?
No, it's not being banned yet.
I thought it was illegal.
No, not yet, no.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. But no, seriously, yeah, when you go to Champagne, I was shocked. You see it in every region. You see herbicide use.
Glyphosate.
Yeah, that's still legal. And actually, this is the interesting discussion.
I'm sorry to swear, but that's disgusting.
Yeah, but the problem is the alternatives to glyphosate are worse. If you don't outlaw all herbicides, you'll get no progress. So the other herbicides that you could use are much more toxic than glyphosate. And this is the problem. People have got obsessed by this one molecule because they've heard about it, but the things people were using before glyphosate were horrible. They'd stick around in the soil for a long time.
So let's come back to those herbicides after we wrap up the tilling piece for people.
Yeah.
So the first option is herbicide.
And then the second option is to plow. So like you might plow in the row and there's various devices to physically deal with the weeds and everything. Plowing is like, it seems really healthy. You see the soil coming up and everything, and it gets rid of the weeds and it looks great. But the problem is it oxidizes the organic material, it damages the microbial growth. So it's not the best thing you can do for your vineyard if you can avoid it. But then there's what's called conservation tillage, which is just disturbing the surface of it. So it's about choosing the right method for you. And I think that initially vines might find the competition with permanent growth a little bit too much, but then after a few years, then they'll adapt to it and they'll be fine. Just depends on your region.
I guess there's one thing of like, there's the vines, there's the cover crops, there's the possible pests, if we call the gophers pests, or they are pests. Yeah. And then there's also different soils, right?
Yeah.
So different soils may need different amounts of work.
Yeah.
Depending on their compaction and what they're
made
up of.
And then you've got slopes as well. And can you some steeply sloped vineyard, it's really hard to get in machinery. So it's like, it's not simple. It's like a recipe doesn't work for this. You have to decide how you're going to manage that. And one of the really interesting approaches is what's called crimping. So you allow a cover crop to grow up.
And that's not related
and then
to
spring,
doing your hair.
Well, it's just kind of silly. But you use a tool that basically, it kind of rolls down the crop that's growing there, but it breaks the stem. So it kind of kills it. So you end up with this mat of dead vegetation, which actually acts like a mulch layer, which is really cool because that keeps the soil temperature from getting too hot. It maintains water in the soil.
Yeah, you get good humidity still.
And then it will slowly decompose and release nutrients to the soil. And
then you don't lose those, like the microbial life doesn't get impacted.
You don't disturb it. Yeah. So it's a really, if you can do that, that's fantastic. It's really just such a good thing to not... Mowing is fine, but mowing isn't the same.
I feel like mowing is just aesthetic, though, isn't it?
Well, you might need to things not to grow too tall, so mowing it stops them growing too tall. But you don't necessarily...
But it does feel a little bit more like it's gardening rather than farming. Yeah.
But I love this idea of crimp. Crimping is really good, having that mulched layer there. Because the key thing to remember is that when you've got stuff growing in the soil, that they... Plants release up to 40% of their photosynthates into the soil to recruit microbial help. So mycorrhizal associations, which you might have heard of, they're very important because around 80% of plants have these intimate associations between the roots and these fungi that grow, through the soil, and they vastly increase the surface area for uptaking nutrients, uptaking water, and they also facilitate communication between plants. So the mycorrhizal association with the roots of a tree, for instance, might actually send nutrients to another tree.
Which again goes back to that sustainability piece and the longevity of the plants that are in that soil, right?
And I love this idea that old vines might be connected by these microbial helpers. And so an old vineyard, you might have a consistency to that because the vines are sort of connected underground. And this is really interesting. And this is an area where it's a mystery what goes on under our feet. And, you know, but it's really important. And the key thing is having things growing in the soil to help facilitate these microbial connections. Mm. And the big problem with artificial fertilizers is the plants won't release stuff into the soil because they've got enough artificial fertilizers. So these microbial connections all sort of die, and it's just a sad, dead soil, and that's not nice.
So that's artificial fertilizers in a very rounded up way. But going back to the herbicides, so we touched Roundup / glyphosate, which has become kind of...
It's almost like it's taken a... So I remember speaking to Steve Mathiasen about this. He's saying, guys, you know, all the old-time farmers, we said, use glyphosate. It's much softer, more gentle herbicide, because glyphosate's much safer because it involves a pathway involving amino acid synthesis that humans don't have and mammals don't have. So the thing that kills the plants can't kill us.
No, but doesn't it? I believed, or I was told, that the body can't metabolize it, so it builds up in the human body, right?
No. It's actually, the problem with glyphosate is it's so safe and cheap, it's become universally used. So even on sufferance, they use it as a secation agent. So the crops, you know, like the wheat and everything and barley, before it's harvested, they'll spray it. Dry it all out. And so all the cereals you eat have got glyphosate. We eat loads of glyphosate.
But that's
really bad.
But isn't that, like, I think there's quite a few people who are working as, like, nutritional doctors and in different sciences that say that there is significant amounts of evidence that show that there are rising cancer rates based on wheat consumption, which they believe is due to glyphosate.
The problem with glyphosate is it acts as what's called a chelator, so it sucks up nutrients. So basically, when we eat stuff that's got glyphosate on
like,
it,
it
vastly reduces the nutritional benefit of this stuff. And we're eating this stuff all the time. And this isn't cool. This is really bad.
Yeah.
But I think that if you just ban glyphosate, because you've heard of it, and the legislatures love to do things that resonate with the public like that, you're going to have farmers going back to the old herbicides, which are worse, like pre-emergence. So glyphosate sticks in the soil for half-life in the soil is about 42 days, so it's bad. But these other ones were designed to stay in the soil for like a year. So my concern is that if you just ban glyphosate, then people use other herbicides that may be less safe and more dangerous and which might persist in the soil longer, and it's like the problem is, generally speaking, is you don't want to be using herbicides, even organic herbicides. I went into the local sort of hardware store the other day, and they had Roundup on the shelf, Roundup, a new formulation or advanced or something, and I looked at it and it said doesn't contain glyphosate.
Well, that doesn't make sense.
I looked at the back and it's like 60% acetic acid. So Roundup has changed, is still using the brand name for a non-glyphosate, because they know that glyphosate, in the US, glyphosate's been banned for domestic use, or, you know, it's just the agricultural use remains. But in the UK, you can buy glyphosate with Roundup. So Roundup with glyphosate, you can buy Roundup that's actually acetic acid. So it works as a herbicide, but it's not systemic, so it will kill the bits you spray.
So it's a better option, though.
But it doesn't work, really, because it kills the bit you spray, but it doesn't actually go down to the roots, which is what glyphosate is. Glyphosate would kill the whole thing. It would.
So, Jamie, how do we inspire people to not use these terrible herbicides?
Basically, what I'm saying is we shouldn't use any herbicides, even if they're organic. Like, acetic acid's organic. Mm. But what you should be doing is creating a balanced ecosystem. And if you can, have plants growing all the year, but just having the right sort of plants growing, that they're not competing too much with the vine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's been a lot of work on this, looking at that in row bit. So just under the vines themselves, that's often the tricky bit to treat. But the other thing is, what's quite interesting is introducing animals into the vineyard. This is a part of regenerative viticulture, which is really interesting because animals really take you forward a long way. Obviously, with some animals, you can't have them in the vineyard when the grapes are there because they'll eat them.
Mm.
So sheep are usually grazing in the winter, and then they leave sort of like when the vines start going. But some farming systems, you know, it would be very interesting to see if we could find a farming system where the grapes are grown, where you could run animals through the vineyard all year round. And suddenly weed control is not an issue. And you're getting the benefit of the recycling of nutrients through the pooing animals, which is really, apparently it has some, I was speaking to somebody who's done a trial, Hartenberg in South Africa. They're really into regenerative viticulture.
Yeah.
And they made a wine from a section of the vineyard where they had regenerative viticulture with no animals, and then regenerative viticulture with animals in the vineyard.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the wines tasted quite different, which is really interesting. And I was at Torres in Spain a few weeks back.
I'd like to know all the factors in that, because I'm like, was it all the same grapes?
Yeah, yeah.
Was
the it's just the same vineyard block. Same vineyard block. They're just part of it where they had animals in, yeah, and part where they didn't. And apparently the animals in the vineyard made a difference to the quality of the wine because of that nutrient
one was
recycling.
Better or...?
Different.
Yeah,
probably
yeah.
Better. I'm guessing it's better, but yeah, maybe not. But Torres, I did a tasting of their regenerative plots versus their non-regenerative plots. I think it was a John Leon vineyard where they did it. And they were different.
Yeah.
And the regenerative plot tasted better. I know it's a small trial.
You know,
it's like, so we're starting to see this idea of once you build up this agro ecosystem, you get more biodiversity. Maybe you get better wine, which is really
interesting. I mean, also, if you get the same wine, but you know that there's more impact maybe it's less impact, a healthier ecosystem, isn't that enough of a benefit to do it?
The benefit is something that's truly sustainable.
Yeah.
And also, if it's regenerative, you reduce the inputs cost money. So you can imagine a situation where you get a natural balance in your vineyards, where you're actually going in less, interfering less, and you're much more sustainable in that way. Your carbon footprint is lower, and you're saving money, and you're getting potentially better wine quality.
Mm. And maybe just for everybody that's listening, the fundamentals, I'm going to pour us a different wine in a second, but the fundamentals of regenerative farming, because I think just because we've obviously kind of slipped into the topic, but like the key, obviously you've said it's the looking at the whole system as one.
It's agroecology in practice. So it's seeing the vineyard as an agro ecosystem where you're encouraging biodiversity, you're looking to improve the soil quality through having more things growing in it by not disturbing it too much. And using a toolkit of approaches like compost, cover cropping, animals, agroforestry, and even things like biochar, which is another thing that's come out recently, not so recently, but it's like people are trialing this in vineyards. It's basically pyrolyzed wood. So it's burnt in a low oxygen environment, like making charcoal.
Mm-hmm.
And this stuff produces a very interesting kind of brittle. And we saw some of this in Tuscany, didn't we? At Felsina.
Yeah.
A big pile of biochar. And once you put this in the soil at a certain rate, maybe you compost it first to load it with nutrients and everything. It helps with water retention. It helps with releasing nutrients to the vine in a controlled manner.
Yeah.
And this can be really helpful as a soil amendment. So people are trying this as well. But it's all these things. It's this toolkit of approaches where you're looking to improve the environment as a whole agro ecosystem so that the environment does the job that previously chemical inputs and interventions would do. And one of the stumbling blocks for true sustainability of vineyards is the fact that Vitis vinifera, which is the species of vine, produces all the varieties we know and love. Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, Sangiovese, Nebbiolo.
From a Eurocentric point of view, maybe?
Yes, yes, this is true. is vulnerable to powdery and downy mildew, the two diseases that came from America,
which are on the rise with
yes.
Did you call it climate chaos earlier?
Yes, yes.
Like, it definitely is, right? Like, I mean, yeah. I live in Berlin, and I can just tell you, this is the wettest, humidest, sort of...
Most humid.
Most humid spring going into summer we've ever had. I mean, the southern half of Germany is having, has for weeks now, like, people's homes are flooded.
Yeah.
Like it's a big deal. So, and it's very stormy. I'm a migraine sufferer, so I feel the air pressure difference, and it's like it's been a year for it, and I feel like the last few years have been like that. A lot of producers are talking about that. So if you've got more humidity, you've got wetter conditions at tricky points, or let's say crucial points,
you just end up having to go and spray a lot more.
Yeah, and then it goes back to that copper topic that you mentioned earlier.
So there's been a lot of interest in. So if you go to America, American grape varieties that have been basically most of them are hybrids of that. So if you go to eastern USA, like Finger Lakes, mm-hmm. or you go to any of the Virginia or any of the regions around there, a lot of the varieties grown there are what we call hybrids. So they're native varieties in the USA that are resistant to these diseases that have been crossed with European varieties, and so you've got this resistance to these fungal diseases. And then you've got also in Asia, you've got Vitis amurensis, which is a vine that again has these resistance genes to these diseases. And so when you start doing crossings of these American varieties, these Asian varieties with Vitis vinifera, you can produce disease resistant varieties, which is very interesting.
Peewee or peewee varietals. That's a finished glass. Now we're.
A new wine coming. There's an intermission. Oh, that's fantastic. Oh,
good sound.
Fantastic sound. So, an intermission before we go back to the disease resistant varieties, we're going to talk about this wine slightly because this is actually, I think, a really beautiful wine. It's actually from California.
Yeah.
It's from the Santa Rita Hills. Chardonnay, 21 vintage from a winery called Sandy. So, Sandy is. Raj Pal, Sashi Mormon, who are both very important, influential wine people in California.
And in the US, I would say, right? Like, yeah.
And this is, I think, a very beautiful wine. I haven't tried it yet, but...
I feel this is a little bit nostalgic for us.
Yes.
For a couple of reasons, because the way that we became friends through... American wine, through you, your connection to Robeson, our mutual connection through Mark Andrew. And also this was the time when we got to know each other in like the early 2010s. This is when this really emerged on the UK market, and it became like one of the most hyped Chardonnay. It was like when Sagrin Wild opened and Sandy was like the hot Cali Chardonnay to drink. It still is, like, but that was a time where it was like, it was very new and it was like very cutting edge. And I think also at your 50th birthday, I met Raj. This was we were at your birthday together.
That's so in
I
just feel 2017.
Yeah, so a while ago.
Yeah.
But like,
oh my.
Yeah, I feel like it's cool that we're tasting it again together. Because I haven't tasted it for, I don't know, maybe like 8-9 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lovely Chardonnay. It's got a
riffing off our riffing off our previous podcast that we did together
on wine faults
and a little bit of, and like
it's a little bit of mashed-up reduction.
Yes, I was going to say healthy reduction, but yeah,
beautiful
positive
wine.
Reduction.
Such a nice wine.
Yeah, it's a serious wine, eh?
So, alternative varieties, very interesting. So, a lot of breeding work is needed to produce.
Peewee varietals.
Yes, which is hybrids that you make that cross, make sure you've got the resistance genes, so you're resistant to powdery mildew and downy mildew.
Well, and also, can I add one other factor? Because I feel like we didn't acknowledge it. Isn't it also about like flowering times and stuff as well? So you're like skipping frost, right? Isn't it some of them, so you're like, they're adaptive for cool climates. So it means that you don't lose the possibility of a harvest because maybe they're... The bud burst is a little bit later, or the flowering is a bit later, that like you've already also skipped some of the really cold area, because a lot of these varietals are also cool climate adapted.
A lot of them have been developed for cool climates, yes. But I think the key thing about their development is that you're looking to have at least two resistance genes to downy and two to powdery, because then that stops the diseases becoming overcoming the resistances that the vine has got. And so once you've got that, then you start back crossing with Vitis vinifera. So you kind of you end up with like 80 or 90% Vitis vinifera genes, and then the resistance genes of the American or Asian variety that you've used as your resistant partner.
Yep.
And a lot of work's been done over the last 20 years developing these. It takes a while to do it. And now people are really planting them in earnest.
No, I mean, it's crazy now. Yeah. It really feels like, especially in the last like 3 to 5 years, it's like taken off.
And so suddenly, it means you hardly need to spray, which is amazing for sustainability. The issue is that some of them taste a little bit different.
Yeah, some of them do.
And they're varieties that you can't really use to sell the wine because they're unusual names.
Yeah.
And I think that they work best in blends where you don't specify the variety.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fantastic. I'd like to see people taking them more seriously. So
maybe doing field plantation, like field blends with them.
Yeah. I'd like to see people taking them more seriously. I first started getting excited about them from Garagista in Vermont.
That's
the first hybrid wines that I tried that I thought, oh, these are really interesting. So they're natural wines from Caleb and Deirdre in Vermont, in the UK's Lake Carved Paren, who brought them in. And so Doug showed me these wines, and they're kind of interesting. You know, they're really, it's showing you people can make something interesting that sells for quite high prices from hybrids. And then I went to Finger Lakes and started trying some wines there. Canada, I've tried quite a lot of hybrid wines from there.
Also, Matthias Varnum now, a couple of his wines are with Piwu varietals.
And also Staffelterhof
For the Moselle.
They're
cool. And quite like, actually, I think that would be the best example for like really good, like yummy. And like good price. Because obviously I love La Garagista, but they're not always in everybody's price point.
And they can go quite crazy. Some of the flavours can be kind of crazy, but the good ones are really good.
There's a producer actually in the Prosecco region, so like in Friuli, called Alberto Lott. And a lot of people don't know the wines. And I got to know Giulia and her husband, Alberto, and they have Galera and they have Bronner planted.
Oh.
And when I saw them, they were like, listen, we grow a lot of Galera, but we sell the Glera to other people, and they're like, Bronner is where we want to focus, because they said they love growing it and it just makes sense for the region, and because they're working without any chemical intervention, that they're like, actually it makes more sense for us, we don't want to interfere.
And also there's Pascaline Le Peltier and Nathan making the Chepica.
Yes.
Pet Nats from...
which are really yummy, actually. Chrissy showed them to me.
But they're making them from, like, the really old, despised hybrids, like Delaware and Catawba in Finger Lakes. And so these are the hybrids that were, like, ancient and, like, kind of can make quite unsophisticated wines.
Do you know, though, Jamie, I thought about this recently, because in the last couple of years, there's been a number of varietals that I maybe was, like, a bit snobby about. Nero Davila was one of them. I was like, not really into that grape. It doesn't really make good wine. I think what I've realised is, actually, I think there's the potential that every varietal can make a really yummy wine, or at least a very good wine. And I think it's all about that person. Like, there's got to be the intelligent decision about where I plant this, how I farm it, what am I making out of it.
When I pick it, all of those things. I agree with you there. I actually believe that if you're a really good wine grower,
you can make a good wine, maybe not a great wine, but a good wine out of any grape.
You just make really cool choices and do something really interesting. And then there's the other thing about regenerative, which is I really am supportive of people trying the new resistant varieties. I think that's really important. I'd like to see more breeding work looking to get warm climate resistant varieties that are basically drought adapted as well. Because drought is a big problem, you know.
But a lot of them kind of naturally are, no?
Well, I think a lot of these
varietals and
diseases with some varieties have been developed for cool climates.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you're wondering what's
why
the future
can't they
of
do
kiwi
something
in...
for the Languedoc or for the Rhone or in southern Italy, you know.
Yeah.
Because still you need to spray, even because obviously you don't get much downy mildew when it's not damp. But powdery mildew is a disease of temperature, not dampness.
Yeah.
So powdery is always a problem as well. And the other thing that's also worth thinking about is how do we trellis vines, and in terms of sustainability, in a warm, dry climate, having VSPs, these big walls of canopies, of big canopies that need a lot of water, is that sustainable?
Well, I also don't understand, like, I mean, when I went to visit Eben Sardi in the Swartland, he talked to me about wired bush vines, and he was just like, describing a trellising system, like just the basic cordon system, as being like a crucifix for a vine, because it's like you're exposing it to so much light, so much heat. Why would you do that? Like, you need the bush vine for all of this. And I was like, it was kind of like a bit of a brutal example,
yeah.
But it really actually was very powerful, because I was like, yeah, cool, yeah, you're right. And actually, if you are in hot climates, why are you not using bush vines? Like, again,
yeah.
It's like smart decisions of. So there's a producer that I know that's based in, like, very close to Noto in the southeast of Sicily. They work in Nero d'Avola. This is the winery that changed my mind about this particular grape, because the acidity, so they're not picking early, Jamie, they pick late September, mid-October. The acidity levels in the Nero d'Avola are between 8 and 9.5 grams.
That's amazing.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And because they're farming biodynamically, fruit sets very close to the ground because they train them very low. And they use the canopy to protect the grapes. So it lengthens the hang time. So you get complexity of flavour. You're picking at phenolic ripeness, but you're maintaining acidity because you're not scorching the grapes. And it's like, again, it's like, these are decisions and considerations you can make as a farmer to define your style and to have a really great wine at the end of the day. And this is what I mean around, like, maybe there aren't any bad grape varieties. Maybe there's just sometimes almost like, just poor choices that are like normalised, that everybody just copies like a format. Oh, just repeat that because that's the way it's been done.
And I think you keep learning stuff every day, you know, when it comes to viticulture. Like, I was chatting to somebody from South Africa who was growing bush vines, and they said, just around flowering time, when they drop crop, what they do is around flowering time, they see any flower clusters that are sticking out. You can see them.
Yeah.
Once you can see, chop them off. Because they're the...
They're going to get dried out.
They will develop bunches of grapes that will be in full sunlight. And what you want is a bunch of grapes that have this dappled sunlight under the shade of the bush vine. And that's really cool. That's a very clever idea, because it's like, you know, you obviously, that's assuming you have enough crop to drop some. Drop it when you see the flower cluster sticking out, you know?
Yeah, and I've never heard that before. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, obviously, we've talked about the foundation of regenerative, but maybe we've skipped past, for a few people who have listened to the podcast, that are not quite coherent on, like, when we describe regenerative, they might be like, but isn't that how all organic is?
Well, I guess organic is taking you a long way on the journey of regenerative.
Yeah.
So regenerative is like it's a badge that's being used. It's kind of trendy to talk about now. But what we're really talking about is good viticulture.
Yeah.
So maybe we don't need that badge. So organics takes you most of the way. The difference is regenerative, you're looking to grow more biodiverse things in the vineyard as part of it. So you can be certified organic if you've got no biodiversity in your vineyard and just you don't use the banned products. You can be certified. But actually, regenerative is going a little bit further, in the sense that what we're trying to do is to create that agro-ecosystem. So you can farm organically in almost an industrial way, as long as you avoid the banned products. But what we're really interested in is the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a really good certification for regenerative was, well, you started from here, you use these tools to get you where you're now. Oh, you've gone to here. So I don't mind how you've got there, don't mind what you've done, but you've gone from here to here, which is good.
Yeah.
And it's that, you know, rather than the process-based, it's results-based. And I like that idea, because process-based, big companies can say, oh, well, this is, these are the rules, we'll stick to their rules, and then we'll do this, but without actually having great results, they just stuck to the rules. And I, so I think a process-based, sorry, a results-based approach is much better than a process-based one.
Mm. And again, I'm kind of hopping around a little bit because we've talked about Piwi varietals, but I feel like it could be worth just acknowledging indigenous varietals because...
Totally, yes. Yeah. So there's two regions where I've come across it recently. One is in Penedès, with Torres have been looking, they've done this variedades recuperades.
Okay.
Where they back in the 80s, yeah, they put adverts into the local papers for anyone who's got strange vines. They don't know what they are. You know that. You know, can we come and look at them?
And so they do the ampelographic.
Yes.
Work?
So yeah. What they did is they, you know, with phylloxera, what happened with phylloxera is the wine pouring break. Phylloxera was like a bottleneck. So this is what almost wiped out, the disease that almost wiped out viticulture in the late 19th, early 20th centuries across the world, really. And so the solution was regrafting onto American rootstock. But a lot of varieties got lost and disappeared almost with that process. And this bottleneck had left a lot of really good varieties kind of like abandoned. And so what Torres were trying to do was to try and identify anything that was maybe traditional in the region but got forgotten about,
yeah,
and try and find these varieties and recover them and then grow them and see whether they're good for the present. We're dealing with a warmer climate and everything, and they've come across maybe half a dozen varieties that they've commercialized now and let other people use, and it's very exciting,
yeah,
to see the old varieties. And also back in the southwest of France, you've got this Saint-Mont, the winery whose name escapes me, Plaimont. So Plaimont have done some really good work, again,
yeah,
recovering some ancient varieties, which in the past maybe made wines that maybe they matured too slowly and they had too little alcohol and too much acidity, but now they're fantastic.
Yeah.
So they've done that, and there's a few of those varieties they've brought back.
Well, also, there's like some crazy old wild vines of some of those varietals down that,
yes,
way as well.
Yeah, they've been looking at this as well. Yeah. Plagioles has been looking at this as well, yeah. Yeah. And then you've got, I was in Valpolicella last week, and yeah, in that region they've discovered some, you know, they've made an effort to look at some of the older varieties that got missed out, and some of them very promising. And so this idea of mining the history of a region for varieties that got forgotten about for the wrong reasons. You know, obviously in many regions in the past, the goal was to create lots of wine. There was a demand for lots of cheap
wine. Well, it's that industrial model again, isn't it? It's, yeah, like, how do we keep the costs as small as possible with the biggest output? Which
also,
we know
also,
is like not sustainable.
In the past, wine was a staple and
yeah,
people needed a lot of it. And some of the northern towns in France, for instance, needed a lot of wine to keep people going because it was like people drank a lot of wine, huge amounts.
But
so what they wanted, they wanted lots
about,
of very cheap wine.
But do you
wine.
Think it was about demand, or do you think it was like...
Oh, totally, yeah, totally. So it was about satisfying demand. And so when
I don't feel,
they replanted...
I feel like it wasn't about like people running out of wine. I just feel like they couldn't sell it for... Like, I feel like in those regions, they couldn't sell it for a certain price, so they needed to make a lot of it.
Partially, yeah, but the demand was for a large volume of inexpensive,
yeah,
wine. So high-yielding varieties won.
Yeah.
Whereas now, I think we're moving to an era where, yes, there's oversupply, so there's not necessarily that demand for high yields, but now the wines that sell and make money are quality wines with something characterful about them. So suddenly varieties that were ignored because they didn't yield enough can be quite interesting, coupled with climate change, which means that some varieties that were a little difficult to ripen now ripen perfectly well and, you know, offer a little insurance against those really hot years. So I think that
yeah,
sort of going back to the old varieties and mining them is a really interesting thing, I think.
I agree. I mean, I looked at places like, I visited Cyprus. It was very interesting. You posted Macaroonis, I think, recently. But
those wines are lovely.
Yeah, I visited the winery. God, it was before the pandemic, like 2018 or something. And I went to Cyprus to visit Cyprus. And it was very interesting because they had, like, a few of the producers had international varietals there, and you're like, why have you got Chardonnay planted in Cyprus, which is one of the hottest islands in this part of the world? But when you tried Zinasteri, the local white, most of the wines were at like 12.5% alcohol, because that varietal is adapted to that climate. So you also get wine that's more harmonious, that you have to manipulate less in the cellar. Again, it's not just about, like, when we talk about viticulture, yes, picking that varietal might mean, or an indigenous varietal might mean less work in the vineyard, but it also often can also mean less work in the cellar and less manipulations in the cellar.
And the market's now ready for those, exploring these varieties. I mean, Torres is a great example, because Torres became famous from Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay.
Yeah.
In Spain, in Penedès. And that's like, I mean, they're good. I mean, the Mas La Plana Black Label, fantastic wine, but it's like, it's out of step with what they're doing now. Now they're going to the indigenous varieties are so much better adapted. But it's fascinating that you've got a lot of countries where...
But amazing.
It's almost they, or regions, they need to prove themselves with the international varieties to get the recognition. And then once they've proved that they can make the good wines, then they can start working with the local ones.
But that's the point. But that's, I think, I mean, we see that a lot in Central and Eastern Europe, right? In particular, and that's when that socio-economic, the context of the place... plays a big impact.
Yes.
And I think that's really important in the storytelling of the place to understand, because I think often we overlook those places because maybe they're not so well known. I mean, that's also why I love producers like, going back to Ligas, you know, they were a winery founded in the 80s where really no one was proud to be farming Greek varietals. Like, very few people were proudly farming Greek varietals when they were doing that. And then they were doing that with biodynamics and permaculture. Like, because Meli's dad was obsessed with Masu, like, or not obsessed, but like very inspired by Masunobu Fukuoka, which, who has now passed away, but wrote the books One Straw Revolution, Sowing Seeds in the Desert, which are all about permaculture, which we haven't talked about, which we should talk about. But I think, again, it's like, there were very few people, like, not everybody had access to that, those resources, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, again, like, we can talk about these could be really exciting systems or the possible route, but like, how do we, like, if we look at it from the context of like, how do you create change, what are the impacts going to be of this, like, how do you inspire, or where do things need to change from here, Jamie, in maybe lesser known regions, or for producers that are just getting started, don't know where to go, costs are difficult, I don't know, but like, what are the challenges? Where do people move on in tricky regions, let's say?
Well, I think that you've raised some really important points. And one of those important points is about starting from where you are. We can't start from, you know, so start from where you are, develop the market for what you've got. And then on when you're on that journey, then you can make these choices. Once, and a part of the key aspect that we're kind of often miss out is this aspect of economic sustainability. So when it comes to farming and producing wine, you need to have customers who are going to buy that wine. And so sometimes you've got to do things that maybe were not your first idea, but you have to be economically sustainable to be truly sustainable. And I think that the whole concept of there's a distinction, I think, between commerce and art. So if you're looking to...
Where does farming fit in that?
If you're looking to please the audience, that's commerce. If you're doing what you feel you need to do as a vocation, this is in your soul, you've seen this vineyard, you need to make this wine from this vineyard, that's art, I think. Mm. And then commerce is what keeps you doing that, you know, if you can sustain that financially.
Yeah.
And people make different choices, and the wines that I choose to drink and that I want to champion are where people have said, this is really what I need to do. I need to do this. It's not maybe the market that is dictating what I do, but it's I'm doing what I do because I know this place can produce something that's really interesting, and therefore I'm following that sort of, that drive.
Mm.
So how does this relate to viticulture? I think it's there are places. And the wonderful thing about wine is that in a harmony, in an interpretive act by a wine grower, a place can be turned into a flavour through the lens of a grape or grape varieties. So you've got this wonderful sort of almost creative but interpretive act where you're taking what's there, this place, and you're imagining what it can do, and then you're planting the varieties, or you're taking a vineyard that's already planted and you're imagining what it can do, but then you're making choices in terms of viticulture in the winery. Then realize that potential in the glass. And I think that's what's fascinating about wine.
I think it's very difficult to add more to that, Jamie. I think it's a beautiful way to end, like to move towards the end of this podcast. Yes. Unless there's something else you really want to add.
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground.
We have.
Yeah. Not so much dead air, maybe a little bit of dead air earlier, but not so much really, you know.
Yeah. I think that's a very nice summary point, actually. So I want to thank you for your time, because you've given a lot of it and I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me though. I feel privileged to be part of your podcast. It's,
for everybody that's listening, your new book.
So the new book is called The New Viticulture. The best place to find it, and I apologise if this is Amazon, because it means it can go to lots of markets. More cheaply and easily than any other way.
I bought it off Amazon, and I'm embarrassed to say it, but I also really wanted your book. I just bought it, like, so I can get it in Germany. Yeah.
And if you want to connect, I'm on the internet quite a lot, so my website's wineanorak.com.
Instagram?
Instagram is Dr. Jamie Good, DrJamieGoode.
Yeah, it's important to know there's an E on the end. Yeah. It's not that he's just good.
And then if you still use Twitter, that's, or X, whatever it's called now, it's just Jamie Good. But yeah, happy to connect this wonderful wine community.
Yeah, and I have to say, you're very, even on X/Twitter, I like that you engage a lot with it all the time. Like I very much enjoyed some of the banter that I also witness on those forums, that you fully engage with it. So it's always it's great to see that, because I'm very passive with my use of that. I'm an observer.
Yes.
But yeah, so thank you to Jamie, and definitely check out the book. I haven't finished his book, but I'm about a third of the way through and I'm enjoying it and very grateful for the read. And then for those of you that want to find the wines, we'll obviously post them in the show notes, but Sandy Santa Rita Hills Chardonnay 21 and the Dahoud Tradition Champagne non-vintage extra root as well, both from the list at Hamyard Hotel. I will link that in, because there's an excellent wine program here that's put together by Lawrence, who is the sommelier. And big thanks to Ferndale for hosting us in the event space, because it's a beautiful room with very good acoustics that I hope you all appreciate. You can find us on Instagram at juice.podcast. And if you want to follow my personal work, it's Vinalupa, V-I-N-A-L-U-P-A. I'm Emily Harmon. Thank you very much for tuning in, and
I'm Jamie Good.